Well, good morning. We have a full court on this Thanksgiving week, and my notes tell me that we have students from Lake Mills High School and Lake in Jefferson County. Is that correct? Would you please stand? Oh, very nice. Well, thank you for joining us. Please be seated. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar, so they know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. If the students can come back after our second argument over the lunch break, Justice Dallet will, there she is down there, she'll come down and chat with you a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court. She won't talk about the substance of the case we're hearing, but I'm sure she'll have a lot of interesting things to say if you have time to come back. Please do. And our first case of the day is Marathon County versus DK. Counsel, are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
May it please the court, I am Assistant State Public Defender Catherine Melko, and I represent Mr. DK. I will refer to Mr. DK as Donald, as I did in the briefs. Today, the court has the opportunity to set the quantity of evidence that the government must present in order to involuntarily confine and sometimes forcibly medicate one of our state's most vulnerable populations in a Chapter 51 initial commitment proceeding. I want to start out by reminding the court how important the initial commitment proceeding is. And the first reason is because it repeatedly escapes appellate review. The initial commitment only lasts 6 months, and appeals can rarely be completed within a such short time frame. The plain language of 80930 contemplates that over 200 days would have passed by the time that an initial brief would be done. And then if the initial commitment melds into an extension, the dangerous to standard is different at an extension hearing. And I know this court will touch on this more with my colleague next, but I wanted to remind them that it is the evidence at this initial commitment that can support a determination of dangerousness years down the road. So if this court does not demand that the county's case be established at the onset, by presentation of sufficient facts that a circuit court can weigh, listen to, weigh, and then determine what dangerousness, the county may never present a witness other than a doctor's testimony at a recommitment hearing again, which would be forming an opinion on the dangerousness recommit standard.
Counsel, can I ask you about the record in this case?
Sure.
Is the statement of emergency detention part of the record?
It's part of the record for purposes of appeal, but it's not something that the court or a trier of fact could rely on in making a determination on dangerousness.
Okay. Were any other elements of the, you know, police report put before the trial court in available for its consideration?
No, there was some police reports that were attached to the emergency detention,
right.
but that was not presented through like a police officer or a fact witness at the final hearing, and it would not be considered absent that.
So would it be fair to say that the only thing that the trial court had available to it to make its findings, the only evidence we had was just the testimonial evidence?
Correct, just the testimony of the doctor.
Okay.
And the doctor's report was also not admitted into evidence. It was not admitted into evidence.
I note we have another case, and there was no doctor report admitted into evidence then. Is that the way they're doing it these days? Why wasn't the report put into evidence? Is there a reason particularly?
So I'm not sure. Counsel for Donald at the trial did cross-examine the doctor on the report, but it wasn't offered into evidence, and then there wasn't a chance for counsel for Donald to object or anything like that. But I do think normally what happens is these are admitted into evidence, but the other thing is if this had been a jury trial, the jury wouldn't have had the report to look at in determining whether or not it came to its opinion. And the court itself doesn't state that it reviewed the report, and it shouldn't have because it wasn't offered into evidence at this hearing.
So is this part of really what you're saying to us, is that state you got to do it the right way? You got to make sure to dot your I's and cross your T's, even if there's something to a potential threat that was made, that it can't, we can't just rely on that. We need a doctor to actually make that opinion. We need a report to be admitted into evidence. I mean, is that part of what your argument is?
That's definitely what part of my argument is. The other part is that what the doctor testified to, Donald does seems to have made statements of an intention to inflict harm to the doctor. So the doctor was a witness to the threat, arguably. But what the doctor's testimony then does is say, I don't know whether Donald's going to act on these thoughts. There's no other aspect, and he doesn't talk about how Donald was acting when these statements were made. Was Donald angry? Was the doctor scared? It's just that he said these things. And what the statute...
Well, no doctor could predict whether somebody's going to act on that kind of a statement, right?
Whether someone's going to act on that kind of statement?
Yeah.
Well, but the requirement is that there be a substantial probability that it's much more likely than not that Donald would act on the statement. A substantial probability of physical harm to others. But, right, we're not asking for clairvoyance, and I know that's what suggested. But we're just asking that the county present enough facts with which a trier of fact could make a finding that Donald was much more likely than not going to substantially.
Do you expect the physician to use those words, or is it enough for the court to be able to glean from the evidence presented from the physician that there is a substantial probability?
This court said in Melanie L. that the doctor should testify to the statutory standard, and I think that's what should happen. The doctor should use the words. But more than that, the doctor's words aren't enough. There still has to be evidence presented that others were placed in. There has to be evidence of the recent overt act, threat, or attempt to do serious physical harm. And then that act has to place. There has to be evidence that others were placed in reasonable fear due to that threat to them.
Counsel Lim, the trial court made a finding here, and I just want to hear how you read this and whether you take it as a. Whether you take it as accurate and supported by the evidence here, but that he's mentally ill, he's a proper subject for treatment, but he testified that he is a danger to others. And he's talking about his testimony here, which he credits. He basically says that's all the court has is the testimony, that he's paranoid and that he has thoughts of harming people and has made threats to the police department that he had thoughts that he wanted to strangle police and kill people. These are homicidal thoughts. And that's what the doctor testified to. So I read this as saying he made threats to the police department directly. The police department received those threats, heard those threats, and they're actual threats to harm the police. That's how I'm reading this language. Is that an accurate reading of it? And do you challenge that factual finding as clearly erroneous?
So we have not challenged any of the factual findings as clearly erroneous. I mean, what you articulate what the court said, that he has made threats to the police department that he wanted. He had thoughts that he wanted to strangle police and kill people. What was presented to the court was that he had made statements to Donald, Donald had made statements to the doctor that he wanted to strangulate the police, or he planned to strangulate the police and harm people that were making fun of him. But so I don't read this as that he actually threatened the police department. There may be evidence elsewhere in the record that was not relied on to support that statement, but that was not actually what was presented at the hearing.
Do the police have to know of the threat to satisfy the standard?
The police do not have to know of the threat, and I think RJ covers that, but what has to be established is that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior. Serious physical harm to them. So it doesn't have to be, the object of the threat does not have to be aware of the threat, but the threat has to be of such nature that others will be placed in reasonable fear. And that's to ensure that it's not, a person is not just expressing like frustration or is just saying puffery, right? We don't just take the statements as themselves as enough. The statute demands more. The statute demands that others will be placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior from those statements.
And your argument is that the only person that's in the record that those statements were made were the doctor, and the doctor's language that he used does not show that there was some fear that he was placed in that this was going to happen. Is that the argument?
Exactly.
Can't the doctor be afraid that perhaps somebody else might be harmed or killed?
I think the doctor could be the other in this situation, but the doctor's testimony in this case is that I don't, he does not, his, he does not voice fear for others. And he also does not express sort of how Donald was acting when these statements were made, so a finder of fact could listen and determine whether or not others were placed in fear of violent behavior. So the doctor could be the other, so he could be placed in fear, but his testimony doesn't establish that he was placed in fear. It only really establishes him.
But isn't this a an objective standard? The statute requires that others are placed in reasonable fear. And that doesn't go to whether a specific individual was actually afraid, just whether a reasonable person would be afraid. And that's objective.
I agree that it is an objective standard because there has to be an objective act of either act, attempt, or threat to do serious physical harm. And I agree that it could be it is a reasonable person standard. But what I think needs to happen then is there needs to be evidence presented on the state, the facts concerning the statement made. So it has to be, how was Donald acting when this happened? Was he angry? Was his face contorted? Was he just expressing frustration? Was he laughing? So if there were more facts in the record in order to establish why someone would be placed in reasonable fear, I think it would be a different story. But all we have is that the statements were made, and the statute by itself does not contemplate that that's enough.
So it is your position that if a doctor hears a direct threat to someone specifically that's serious, that's real, that's imminent, whatever, that the doctor can be an other, or that the person other than the doctor, I suppose, who didn't hear it, could be afraid as well? Are you just saying that wasn't satisfied here? You're not disagreeing with that proposition, that either the doctor or people who don't hear it, even though the threat's only made to the doctor, that could be enough to satisfy the standard that, you know, hey, the police could be afraid because he told the doctor he wants to strangle and kill the police chief. But that's a permissible standard that's just not met here. Is that your argument?
Yes, that is my position. The doctor appears to be, you know, a witness to the threat, that Donald made statements to him that could be construed as a threat. But there's no evidence establishing how Donald was acting while this threat was made, no evidence with which a reasonable fact finder could find that others were placed in fear.
Isn't your standard then, isn't your burden to show that the trial court's conclusions were clearly erroneous on that question?
So the question, this has a mixed standard review, whether or not a person is dangerous under the statute. The findings of fact are entitled to deferential review, but whether those facts meet the higher standard of dangerousness is a question of law that this court reviews de novo.
So the question of whether reasonable fear element was established, that's just a question of fact, right?
Yes, that would be a question of fact.
Okay. But the trial court found that there was reasonable fear in this case.
I don't believe the trial court found there was reasonable fear. He found that statements were made, that threats were made, but there was no finding of reasonable fear.
Good. I don't want to interrupt you, but
please.
Okay. 5129A is the provision that deals with the court. I'm just trying to hearken back on when I did these. When the court, the matter comes into court, probable cause determining certain orders, if that threshold level is met, certain orders are executed by the court. Included within those orders is the order under 5129A that deals with the court appointing the examiners to examine the subject. Then under 5129A and the subparts there under, those reports, of course, have to contain certain information. That information is now in a form that they can file with the court. But it then is required to be filed with the court. Is it your position that the filing with the court of the report is insufficient for purposes of admitting that document into evidence for the court's consideration later? Because, I mean, I think the court can look at things in the file. Or are you saying, no, the court is prohibited from considering the reports that the court ordered be filed with the court?
So whether the court, I mean, the court, it was filed with the court. You're right that the statute contemplates that two doctors are appointed, two doctors evaluate, and then two reports are filed. But whether or not it was considered by the court and whether or not the trier of fact considered it in determining where this court is reviewing for a sufficiency analysis is a different question. And that's because the report, had the report been admitted into evidence, so had Corporation Counsel asked to admit the report into evidence, there could have been objections made to the hearsay within the report. There could have been, it's not necessary that the whole report would have been used at that or accepted at that time, admitted at that time. But it was not admitted into evidence at the hearing.
So what's your best support for the notion that a court-ordered report that the court orders be filed for with the court cannot be used by the court?
Well, first off, the court does not say it relied on the report in its statements, making its findings of fact and conclusions of law. It does not say, I have the report, I have the doctor's testimony. It just says, all I have is the doctor's testimony.
And the doctors didn't reference their own reports in their testimony?
Just the one doctor testified, and he was asked questions about his report, but he did not, the report was not admitted as an exhibit. It was not offered into evidence. And if this had been a jury trial, right, the jury would
but
have...
But it wasn't.
Right.
It's a court
it was
trial.
Not, yep, it was not. The jury would have never heard evidence that was not admitted into evidence. So
I understand the distinction. Yeah. I'm just trying to... My question really was, what's your best support for the notion that a court ordered and filed with the court report can't be used by the court?
Yeah, and I think also it's just not fair because, again, there could have been objections made by defense counsel for what the report could be used to establish. Could it be just used to
okay.
the doctor's conclusions? But, yeah, it was not entered into evidence at this hearing.
Understood. Thank you.
Counsel, you seem to have framed the issue in the petition for review as somewhat of a records question. That is... when the county's sole witness testifies, so you have here the doctor and you have the testimony, you're circumscribing the question. When the county's sole witness testifies that decay could be potentially dangerous, does this evidence constitute clear and convincing evidence that decay is currently dangerous? Am I correct to say that this is really based on this record, as all cases are, but you seem to be uniquely circumscribing the framing of your question as to the import of this is based on one witness's testimony and that's the entire record?
Yeah, I think that's the problem in this case. It's one doctor who testified originally, who he was asked, is Donald a substantial risk of danger to himself or others, and the doctor answered to other people. So that itself doesn't comport with the statutory language that Donald evidences a substantial probability of physical harm. And then compounding that testimony, which is confusing, the doctor repeatedly answers that Donald was potentially dangerous, could be still potentially dangerous, and then confirms that he said could be still potentially dangerous.
Okay. What about now, as I recall in reading the transcript, the county did have another witness that it wanted to call, but the judge didn't, a police officer, and the judge didn't allow that testimony. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that was a police officer detective that wasn't properly noticed, so it wasn't the defense or the counsel for respondent objected with saying for notice that this detective was going to be called.
So the detective was there, but not able to get on the stand because
the detective was
procedural
there.
Problem.
Yes.
Counsel, I just want to get back to this standard. We talked earlier about reasonable fear, whether that's an objective standard versus a subjective standard, and also whether it was a fact question or not. It strikes me that if it's an objective standard, it wouldn't be a fact question. And so I just wanted to see if you might help explain this statutory language that evidence that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them, and whether that, to what extent is that a fact question, to what extent is that a legal determination that we make since we are reviewing this, as you rightly noted, de novo, in terms of whether the statutory standard is met.
So I believe that it's It's an object. So what, I think the standard is objective, a mixed objective subjective standard. So the whether or not there was a recent overt act, attempt, threat to do serious physical harm, that's an objective act. And then whether it would place a person in reasonable fear, I think that could be satisfied through subjective testimony, but I also think it could be satisfied through objective testimony, if that makes sense.
So if it's objective, would that be something that we could look at the trial court findings and or evidence and then determine whether that's been met?
If there had been evidence with which if the doctor had produced testimony on how Donald was acting during these statements that he heard, then yes, I think the court could look to see if that was satisfied in the record. But my position is the doctor did not establish any sort of facts or reasonable facts with which this court could make reasonable inferences to come to that finding.
Why aren't his words enough? Where do you find the requirement that we have to consider his actions and that his words are insufficient?
The plain language of the statute. So the statute contemplates not just that a statement of a threat is made. It requires that evidence that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior to them from those statements. So just the fact that the statements were made can't be enough, because why do we have this other part there in the statute then?
Okay, but he did make the statements to the physician, correct?
Correct.
And even though he was threatening the police chief with his statements, he didn't have to make it to the police chief to satisfy the statute, correct?
It did not have to make it to the police chief. The Court of Appeals in RJ said that, and also just to be clear, the evidence about the police chief was not evidence that was introduced at this final hearing. That was part of the emergency detention petition. But RJ holds that the person whom the threat is made to does not have to be aware of the threat. But it does hold that others have to be placed in reasonable fear of physical harm to them from the threat.
Well, if when you add that to them, others have to be placed in reasonable fear to them, to me that focuses it right back on the person about whom the threat is made, correct?
And that was actually the challenge in RJ, was the attorney argued that the person whom the threat was made should be aware of the threat. And what the Court of Appeals said is that no other can be people that are placed in reasonable fear on behalf of the person threatened.
Okay. So why couldn't the doctor be placed in reasonable fear of the police chief being harmed absent Donald's commitment?
So I think that's the question, right? I think there could have been evidence presented, possibly, or the county could have asked additional questions if it wasn't sure whether or not the doctor was placed in reasonable fear, or getting more evidence in about how Donald was acting when these statements were made, so that a reasonable finder of fact could make those findings.
But the person to whom Donald made the threats was a psychiatrist, right?
Yes, at this hearing.
And so he looked at Donald as a physician charged with evaluating someone's mental state.
Correct. That was his job in this case.
Thank you.
I forget, is Dr. Dave a psychiatrist or a psychologist?
He is a psychiatrist, I believe, but there's a couple of Dr. Daves, but I believe he is a psychiatrist.
Okay. The thing that's been a problem for me in this case is the testimony of the doctor that he is, could possibly be, DK could possibly be dangerous. And he said that and variations of that several times. It just doesn't seem that could possibly be equals substantial probability, or as we have interpreted it, much more likely than not. What am I missing?
I'm with you on that. I think that the phrasing that the doctor uses, potentially, and potentially or could be dangerous, does not amount to that standard of much more likely than not. The words can't be read in conjunction. I think that, especially when we look at the burden of proof that the county is required to meet at this sort of case, which is the clear and convincing evidence standard. So it's testimony that someone is potentially or could be potentially dangerous does not equate to clear and convincing evidence that someone currently is a danger to himself or others.
Counsel, I'm just looking at the statutory language here. It's odd. Evidence is a substantial probability of physical harm to other individuals as manifested by. So, you've got this sort of, here's the standard. Okay, so here's how we tell if that standard was met. So we kind of don't care as much about the standard language if we meet what it says we're supposed to meet. It would seem that that would be a reading of it, at least. And evidence by, others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them. So if we concluded that there was evidence that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them, doesn't that meet the statutory standard that there's a substantial probability of physical harm to other individuals under the statutory language, or am I reading that incorrectly?
I think you're reading that correctly, but it's our position that there was no evidence with which the court could make that finding. And I think if we look at this court's decision, Michael H., there were four witnesses that testified to four fact witnesses. So his mother, the nurse at the hospital, the police officer who brought Michael back to the hospital, and then also the doctor. They all testified about Michael's behavior over a one-week period. And the doctor's testimony there was that Michael could be dangerous without treatment. But this court found that even despite that finding, there was substantial evidence in the record to support.
So all this, though, the argument about whether it's much more likely than not and how that compares to language that he could be dangerous or potentially dangerous, it strikes me that under the statute's language, at least if I heard you correctly, that none of that matters. The only question in this case would be whether there's evidence that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them. And if that's met, that equals the statutory standard of substantial probability of physical harm. So we don't care so much about the language. I mean, it's an odd structure for a statute, but I'm just looking at the language of the statute here. Is it much ado about nothing with the...
I see my red light is on. May I answer?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. So I do think it's important that the doctor testified that it was potentially dangerous, and I think that...
That it was potentially dangerous? I just didn't hear that.
Yeah, he did. I do think that the potentially dangerous does not match up with the statutory subsection of the substantial probability of physical harm. And I think, Justice Hagedorn, your question is, we don't care that much about that because if we have the other evidence, that's okay. And I think the problem here is this is the only evidence that we have. This doctor's testimony is all that we have. And so in concluding trying to figure out whether or not it was much more likely than not that Donald was going to harm others, we're kind of left with this potentially dangerous. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, Honorable Justices, Deputy Corporation Counsel Michael Pierner appears today on behalf of the petitioner-respondent, Marathon County. Your Honors, although I will only reference specific facts as necessary to support the county's position, I do want to briefly emphasize the procedural posture of this case. This case comes from the Circuit Court in Winnebago County, and that Circuit Court made specific findings at the final hearing on May 11, 2017, when considering the matter of Donald's mental commitment. The court found, based on the uncontroverted testimony of Dr. Dave, that Donald suffered from a mental illness that seriously affected his thought and perception. The court also found that Donald was a proper subject for treatment and that Donald was a danger to others based upon his homicidal thoughts expressed and his threats described in detail by Dr. Dave.
Counsel, did the circuit court find that others were placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm?
I think the court did make that finding implicitly by the findings of fact that it did make.
Is it sufficient for a trial court to make implicit findings in a commitment proceeding?
I think it is in this case, Your Honor. I think the review here has to be of the entire record and the entire testimony of the doctor. The doctor is the only one who provided testimony and evidence at the hearing.
Can you point to the doctor's testimony in which he described how others would be placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior in Syria?
Certainly. Dr. Dave, on multiple occasions, testified about the specific threats that Donald made against police.
Yeah, but and I'm aware of where he testified about the statements. But where did he say that that would put others in reasonable fear of violent behavior?
And I think that's the inference that the trial court made here, was that the threats that were made to police, coupled with the delusional disorder and the impaired judgment that the doctor testified to, all of those in conjunction created the situation where the officers, if they had heard the threats, would have been placed in reasonable fear of harm. It's the totality of the circumstances here, I think, that carries the day for the trial court and should carry the day in this court as well.
But the only thing the court had to go on was the doctor's bare recitation of the threats. Did he say anything anywhere in the hearing that would help the circuit court understanding the seriousness of the threat? Right? I mean, the threatened harm obviously was serious, but what we've got to figure out is, was there any likelihood of this happening? Right? Was this an off-the-cuff remark? Was it frustration? Was he joking? Was he dead-on serious? If I get out of here, this is what I'm going to go do. Where is there anything in the record that tells us how seriously we should take those threats?
Certainly. I think that the emphasis here should be on the threats combined with those impairments. So Dr. Dave was very specific that when he examined Donald, Donald's judgment and behavior were impaired to a substantial degree.
So let's say that's true. I don't think anybody's challenging that. So his judgment is substantially impaired, and he's made these statements. Now we need something to link those up, right, and say because of his substantial impairment, that produces a reasonable risk that this is what's going to actually happen. Where do I find that?
Dr. Dave did testify when asked the question about linking those two items that it was most possibly, now these are the doctor's words, most possibly that Donald could act on those delusional thoughts. And that's the concern raised by this delusional disorder that the doctor testified to, is that the probability of that happening is the concern and the reason why this commitment proceeding was started.
How about at least in part 11.6, 11.7, and 11.8, where he talks about whether he's able, if the doctor formed an opinion as to whether or not he presented himself with a substantial, doctor said other people. He asked what he was basing that on, and he talked about paranoia, thoughts of harming other people, people making fun of him, threats against the police department. They were not listening to him, that he was thinking about talking to the police. Then he said killing people who were making fun of him, that he planned on strangulating the police officer, and also killing people who made fun of him. And then he went on a little bit more. Does that factor in at all?
Absolutely, Your Honor. What Dr. Dave testified to has to be taken as a whole. We can't take pieces out of the testimony and then point to that and say that that's not sufficient.
All right. So I think Justice Ziegler did an excellent job of stating the strongest case that you have. Am I correct about that? Is that the strongest case that you have?
I believe those are the strongest facts in the record, yes.
All right.
And I think it's important to note that we're here reviewing the circuit court's findings of fact, so we're not looking for an alternative interpretation.
Yeah, except that you said that the facts that we're interested in here were implicitly found. And I'm not sure what to do with that.
So the circuit court's findings of fact included that, because the circuit court didn't use the magic words related to a reasonable person was placed in fear of significant or substantial risk of harm. Those magic words weren't spoken, but implicit in the entirety of the circuit court's findings, did that standard was met. And that's because of the entire record here. The circuit court noted Dr. Dave's testimony was uncontroverted. The circuit court noted that Dr. Dave testified that there was a major mental illness, a delusional disorder, and that the capacity for Donald to recognize reality and his ability to have proper judgment was severely impaired. And then the circuit court goes on to say Dr. Dave testified that Donald is a danger to others, he is paranoid, he has thoughts of harming people, and he has made threats to the police department that he wanted to strangle police and kill people. So although the circuit court doesn't come out and say those magic words from the statute, the transcript of the circuit court's findings is very specific on those points.
Yeah, but the magic words here are really pretty important, aren't they? We're talking about depriving someone of their liberty, and based on some threats that they made. So isn't it really, really important that we focus on, are these real threats? Yes, we know that he has a disorder, he's schizophrenic. Yes, we know that impairs his judgment. Yes, we know that the threats were connected to his impaired judgment and his schizophrenia. Okay, all of that, let's take that as given. Now, we have to figure out, are these threats of the nature that a reasonable person, knowing all of that background, are these threats of the nature that a reasonable person would be in fear of physical harm? And I'm just, that's the implicit, that's what you're relying on as being an implicit finding, except that's the whole ball of wax here. The whole question in this case is, would a reasonable person be in fear of physical harm? And we're just supposed to imply that?
Well, I think the totality of the record makes that implicit finding very clear. The Court of Appeals has...
Hang on a second. No. So the record, what the record makes really clear is that all of these things are connected. What the record appears to be silent on is whether a reasonable person would be placed in fear of physical harm because of those threats. Where do I find something other than just something implicit?
Well, Your Honor, and I think the circuit court here looked at the entirety of the record and found, on the basis of those paranoid delusions, the threats to the police department, the specific threats, on that basis, the circuit court then found that it was appropriate to commit Donald. The circuit court in this case was specific in emphasizing those threats, and although the circuit court did not, as you indicate, make that reasonableness argument explicitly, I believe it was implicit here, and that the circuit court indicated that Donald's thought and perception was affected.
Counsel, it seems that underlying that maybe related question here is we have, particularly when we're reviewing something at the appellate level, we review the legal standard de novo. We defer to the findings of fact. But in these cases, it seems like trial courts don't often make a lot of findings of fact, or at least in this case, we don't have much. We have a pretty limited but two-sentence factual finding that relates to these issues. There was a bit more on the whether there was a mental illness component. So when we have testimony that the trial court appears to credit, but that it makes very limited findings of fact, we are charged on review with a de novo review of whether the evidence supports the legal standard. What are we to do with the gaps between the findings and the legal standard? Are we to assume the trial court credited this testimony? And I take from your argument there's something along those lines, and maybe on rebuttal, I'd be interested in hearing your opposing counsel's thoughts on this too. But what are we to do with this area where there are not facts found? We just have evidence in the record, and we're supposed to connect the dots ourselves as an independent matter.
Certainly, Your Honor. And I think... Justice, you did identify the bareness in the record here of those specific findings. However, there still, I believe, has to be great deference to the trial court's findings because they are the sole judge of credibility. They're in the courtroom. They're.
I'm not disputing the trial court's findings. My question is, what do we do with the areas where there are no clear findings? We just have evidence that's presented. What are we to do with those gaps?
I believe this court should apply the legal standard here. And as the court indicated during the my counsel's argument earlier, it is an objective standard. So I think this court can apply that legal standard to the facts that were presented at the trial court, even if the circuit court did not specifically find that reasonable person standard was met. I think implicit in the findings, based upon the entirety of the record, I think this court can make that review and make that finding.
Well, what about opposing counsel's argument that she's making, which is, yes, we could do that if there was actually something in the record to look at. We don't have any information about how he was acting. There's nothing in this record about the circumstances under which those statements were made. And coupled with that, we have a doctor who put everything in terms of possibility and never met the standard of substantial probability.
Well, I think the first thing that we would want to look at is the circuit court's findings were not perfect in this case. However, I don't think there was any clear error in their finding as well. At this level, I don't think we are charged with searching the transcript for an alternative theory. I think we're looking at whether the evidence and testimony presented created a basis for the circuit court to make a finding that commitment was appropriate in this case.
Well, the doctor didn't just speak in terms of possibility. He did use that word during his testimony. He said it is most possibly that he might act on those thoughts, not realizing that these are not real thoughts. But he did say that he presented a substantial risk of danger to others. And I'm going back to the statutory language because I think that is what we need to apply regardless of what the circuit court expressly said. Circuit courts are busy, busy places, and sometimes the trial judges don't use the exact statutory language when they're expressing their findings. But the statutory language speaks to a substantial probability. Do you think a substantial risk of danger is equivalent to a substantial probability?
I do, Your Honor, and I think that's a very important point that you made, Justice Bradley, is we have to look at this entire record, and this record does have those statements of most possibly, but it also does have the doctor's testimony about a substantial risk of harm to others. Those were specific statements made by Dr. Dave, and that does seem to be a statutory standard in this case.
What do we make of the language that Dr. Dave used? Quoting, he probably may have acted on those thoughts.
Well, I think we have to make sure that we're not requiring doctors to be clairvoyant. Doctors are not trained to provide testimony in legal terms. They're trained to provide expert medical testimony. So this doctor was doing his best to put into words for the court what he felt without being clairvoyant. So he wasn't able to predict to beyond a reasonable doubt that an action would occur, but he was able to state, based upon the type of mental illness here, the delusions that he observed, and the threats that were made, what kind of probability there was that that would happen. He can't be certain of that, certainly, but he was able to testify to the best degree that he can under his professional judgment.
We don't expect doctors to give us certainty, but we do ask them to use magic words in terms of their testimony. We do it all the time. In an injury case, it has to be to a reasonable degree of medical certainty. If it's not, it's not enough. So why is it any different here that the doctor is not held to a standard that is set forth in the statute in terms of showing the risk?
Well, I think this doctor in this case did meet the statutory standard. He testified to a substantial risk of harm to others. I think that does meet the statutory standards. The doctor was also very specific about what he observed from DK, what kind of threats were made. I think that the circuit court and the doctor's failure to recite those specific other magic words We still have to take the totality of that testimony, which included his statement that he did believe there is a substantial risk of harm to others.
Counsel, when you say magic words, that's been floating around here. I wish I had some magic words some days. But the magic words that you're referring to are the substantial probability. Is that what you're referring to?
I believe those are specific statutory requirements. I think the magic words that seem to be requested by Donald in this case go to that probability. So I do think those are the magic words that we're talking about.
As referenced earlier, we have questions, you know, we know all the time. You, doctor, do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of medical, for instance, medical certainty or medical probability?
Right.
We've held consistently that the evidence has to meet that standard of testimony, otherwise it is inadmissible, right? And so it seems to me, I just have problems with this. Let's take a look at the statute itself. What do you think about this? I'm looking at 51.20, and of course we're looking underneath 1B. Evidences a substantial probability. So that's where we have the words. You following along? With
yes.
Evidences a substantial probability of physical harm to other individuals. And it goes on, and what I think is being relied on here. By evidence that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them. The way that I look at this, in order to give meaning to the statute, in order to not read out the import of substantial probability, is this. I see that the clear and convincing standard, in terms of historical facts, has to be that by clear and convincing evidence, there must be evidence that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them. And that's where the clear and convincing comes in. And that folds into a separate inquiry, assuming that there is clear and convincing evidence of that, which I just read, then there has to be a medical or a psychiatric conclusion that it represents a substantial probability of physical harm to others. And so one way of looking at the statute is that if you prove these underlying facts by evidence that is clear and convincing, that constitutes a substantial probability. Another way of looking at the statute is that if you prove the underlying facts that is clear and convincing, and it has to be not just any facts, these specific facts, that informs whether or not there is a substantial probability. In other words, that the doctor's testimony is still held to the requisite standard of whether or not there is a substantial probability. So one subsumes the other on one hand, and on the other hand, it informs the requisite standard of substantial probability. And remember, this is something we've worked on for a while. It isn't just probability, like I said earlier, a reasonable probability in a medical standard, you know, or a reasonable certainty. Doctor, do you have an opinion? We've said this is substantial probability. The legislature must be meaning something more than just probable. Substantial probability. So how do you see this statute? How do you interpret this statute? What camp do you fall into?
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that the substantial probability is informed by the requirement of those threats that would put a reasonable person at fear of serious physical harm. I think that's the best way to harmonize the statute, give meaning to both pieces of it while not basically saying that the second part is duplicative of the first.
Yes, that's my concern, because that's what I heard your opposing counsel argue or advance, that that you meet substantial probability if you show evidence which that others are placed in reasonable fear of violent behavior and serious physical harm to them. And that in and of itself, if there's evidence of that, that means a substantial probability.
Right, and I think that if you read it that way, where the second part is completely subsumed by the first, we're losing the meaning of part of that statute. I think we have to look at the substantial probability of dangerousness being informed by those additional clauses. So when the circuit court is making that substantial probability of dangerousness finding, the circuit court looks at the separate portions of the statute to determine, okay, what type of facts have been presented today, and is it sufficient to inform my opinion and my actual legal conclusion as to the substantial probability of danger?
There's no question that the circuit court order had the proper legal standard in it, right?
That's my opinion, yes.
Well, it's the form that has the
Correct.
Proper legal standard in
the
it,
order,
right?
The order did cite each of the standards. It's a standard circuit court form, and it did make the requisite findings.
There's no, as I understand it, no one's disputing that the court order, and the court order that, by the way, was referenced when the court was on the record, the court referenced it would be signing that order, that restates the proper legal standard, right?
I don't believe that's being challenged today. That's
okay.
Correct.
So are we to search the record to support the court order, or are we supposed to search the record to call into question what the court order could be? How should we be looking at the record as an appellate court?
I think we're looking at the record for any clear error in the circuit court's findings of fact. I think the circuit court order here, the written order, properly applies the law as it's written. And the legal analysis, the legal review is the de novo review. However, if those legal findings and those legal conclusions are based upon the correct law, I think this is a review for clear error. I don't think we should be searching the record for a contrary interpretation of X. I think what we're searching here is there any clear and obvious error that would not
factual
allow the circuit
error.
Actual error that would not allow the circuit court to make those findings?
Or is it the conclusions that we're focusing on, which, of course, we review de novo as a matter of law?
And I think when we look at the conclusions outlined in that written order and in the circuit court's findings, there's no question that the circuit court applied the law. The circuit court incorporated the written findings. The circuit court referenced the statutes in that written order. And so I think that would be a de novo review if there was something incorrect in those legal conclusions, but there's been no challenge to those. So I think today's review is one for clear error in the actual factual findings by the circuit court. And, Your Honors, I want to emphasize again that I think this court can take today's case as an opportunity to emphasize the great deference that appellate courts should give to a trial court which is acting as a fact finder and applying the well-formed legal standards that this court did. Today's case provides this court a chance to repudiate attempts to require a medical expert to parrot the statutes exactly. Instead, this court can emphasize that the entirety of our record is what the trial court should rely upon to determine meaning, to make factual determinations, and to apply the law as written.
How far can we take this idea of relying on implicit factual findings? If the court simply said nothing more than, we find that the patient is dangerous, can we say, well, he implicitly found all the things that go into a finding of dangerousness? Would that be sufficient?
I think this court would need to require more from the circuit court than simply that finding, but
Why?
Well, because the circuit court has to provide some basis of reasoning for its legal conclusions. Otherwise, this court has no way to review anything for clear error.
So how far down do we take that? Because one of the things that I'm struggling with is finding something anywhere in the record to suggest that the trial court found that a reasonable person would be placed in fear by these statements. And I don't find anything like that. So you're inviting us to say that, well, he implicitly found that.
Well,
so you're saying it's okay to be implicit at that level, but not at the level of, well, we just find he's dangerous.
Correct. I think, as we discussed a bit earlier, the reasonable person standard here informs that ultimate finding of fact, which is a legal conclusion, the substantial probability of dangerousness.
Are you sure you want to go there? Because the how are you pronouncing his name? Dr. Dave?
Dave.
Dr. Dave was, whatever words he chose, they were below substantial probability, weren't they?
At certain points, he indicated probability, but at other points, he did testify to substantial risk, substantial probability. I don't think we can isolate one phrase and keep it away from the rest of the record where he talks about those significant delusions and the...
Is a significant risk, or is a substantial risk the same thing as a substantial probability?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And just to be clear, that statement you're talking about is kind of an interesting question and answer. Based on your interview of Mr. K, were you able to form an opinion as to whether or not he had presented a substantial risk of danger to either himself or others? And the answer was to other people. So it wasn't even an answer to the question.
Well,
about
I think
his opinion and the degree of his opinion, which is what we're talking about here.
But I think his response was to other people, indicating yes, to other people.
Okay, except it doesn't say yes to other people. So that's the one statement in here that's different than all the other times that he said possibly and some of the other language he used that was not ever substantial probability, but you want us to rely on that one statement.
I don't think so. I think the entirety of the testimony includes the statements that Donald's impairment is to a substantial degree, his judgment is impaired to a substantial degree, that would seem to meet the requirements. And he does go on to link the impairment of...
Wait a minute, substantial impairment is the same thing as substantial probability of business?
Well, I think when you look at the substantial impairment coupled with the threats that were made, that's when you make that implicit finding, as we have discussed.
I don't think we have to go into implicit findings, do we? Because Dr. Dave, in response to a question posed, and how was his judgment impaired by those thoughts, Dr. Dave said, because he was expressing those thoughts, and he probably may have acted on those thoughts to other people.
Correct. And he also stated later in the transcript, most possibly. So
possibly and most possibly equal the statutory requirement of substantial probability.
I think most possibly and the substantial probability that Justice Bradley just referenced, those are the proper statements and they do meet the standard.
Can a possibility be below 50%?
I think a possibility could be below 50%, yes.
So what's most possible?
I would like to ask the doctor that myself at this point, but I do think that most possible in light of the delusions is the doctor saying to the trial court, look, I can't predict the future and say for certain that these threats would be acted on, but I think it's most possible. I think that does meet the standard. I think that's a very clear statement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Can I just verify at the outset that there's no challenge to the circuit court order having the proper legal standard in it?
It's the form order that checks that Donald is a danger to himself or others based on one of the four standards other than Right. Subsection E.
The court order that happens to be a form.
Right. Yep, the court-ordered form.
Don't we privilege the court's written order over its oral ruling?
I mean, no. Usually oral pronouncements trump the written order. Yeah. So the oral pronouncement would trump. I just want to be clear that we are focused on the legal conclusions, and this is a de novo review. Opposing counsel was arguing that we should look at this for clear error review of factual findings, but our challenge has always been whether these facts reach the threshold of dangerousness, and that is a clear de novo review of this court. In the briefs, there was no argument that we are looking at this for factual, clear factual error. What we're asking this court to do is apply the plain language of the statute to the facts, undisputed facts found by the circuit court, and that is de novo. Justice Bradley's statements about whether or not the second part of the subsection informs the first part, we do need both. They're two separate things. We need the underlying facts, the threats, and the reasonable fear, and we also need the doctor's opinion that there's a substantial probability of risk of harm to others. And here we just don't have that. Substantial risk to other people does not equal substantial probability of harm to others. And we cannot be committing people based on implicit findings of reasonable fear. We need this court to hold that. I think an easy, not an easy way, but I think one way this court could write an opinion or find today is that the plain language of WSSTAT 5120, 1A2B, the statutory subsection at issue in this case, requires the county to present the witness to the recent overt act, attempt, or threat to do serious physical harm to establish that others were placed in reasonable fear of harm to them. And I think that's also an important characterization that what we were discussing. It's not just objective reasonable harm. It's reasonable harm to them. So it's not that the court was placed in reasonable harm. It's that others were placed in reasonable harm who heard the threat. So on balance, I think this is a pretty small request when we think of the great liberty interest that's at stake. Requiring the county to present more facts to the recent overt act, attempt, or threat to do serious physical harm would not be unduly burdensome.
You seem to suggest that, based on your initial argument, that there has to be more than one person who heard the threat. Are you arguing that it's not sufficient that the threat was voiced to the doctor, although not directed at him?
What I'm saying is that the county chose to call the doctor as the witness to the threat. But what the doctor could not establish was that others were placed in reasonable fear of physical harm to them.
Are you asking us to overturn RJ? Because in that case, the Court of Appeals held, we conclude that a showing can be made that others are placed in a fearsome position by a disturbed person's actions, even if the person placed in that position has no subjective awareness of it.
I am not asking this court to overrule RJ. But what RJ held was that the person at who the threat was directed at did not need to be aware of the threat. But the threat in RJ, the individual in RJ made the threat to other hospital personnel at a hospital that she worked with. And so did the individual she threatened. So the court found that others could be placed in reasonable fear from this threat due to the circumstances of the threat.
But the court in that case also gave other examples, and it indicated that no commitment could result from threats directed at those too young, too emotionally undeveloped, or too foolish to reasonably fear another, nor could commitment result from menacing gestures made behind the back of a blind man or from threats hurled into the wind. Are you asking us to disregard those types of threats? Because
no, not at all, but someone heard those threats, right?
And here the doctor heard the threats.
Right, here the doctor heard the threats, but the doctor did not provide any facts with which a fact finder could find that others would be placed in reasonable fear of harm to them. There was no evidence of how Donald was acting when these threats were made. Was he laughing? Was this an expression of frustration? Was his face contorted?
I think the doctor expressed that given his mental illness, where he was in a delusional state, the doctor expressed that people in a delusional state may actually believe, in Donald's case, somebody's making fun of me, and he said, I'm going to kill those people, in so many words, who are making fun of me. That's not enough?
No, that's not enough, because okay. We don't have any evidence of how Donald was acting when these threats were made. We just have that Donald was mentally ill, and he made these statements, and the statute requires more.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you both for interesting case and for very good briefs. We are going to take a break now so that some people can come out and others can join us.